Chapter 11. It was a sudden spring. The breath out of the earth came and went, and when it passed, it took winter with it. The trees were miraculously clothed in leaf and blossom. The frosted earth gave way to blades of summer grass, to bluebells and melancholy thistle. Sunlight danced everywhere. In the branches birds courted and nested, and from the quickened thicket a red fox appeared, regarding Will with a fearless gaze, before trotting off about his business, his whiskers and coat gleaming. "Jacob," said a reedy voice off to Will's left, "I thought not to see you again so soon." Will turned to the speaker, and found a man standing a few yards off, leaning against a graceful ash. The tree was better dressed than he, his stained shirt, coarse pants and ill-made sandals far less flattering than the flickering leaves. Otherwise, man and tree had much in common, both slender in body and limb, yet finely made. The man, however, boasted something the tree could not. Eyes of such a flawless blue, it seemed the sky had found its way into his head. "I must tell you, my friend," he said, staring not at Jacob but at Will, "if you still hope to persuade me to go with you, you're wasting your breath." Will looked around at Jacob in the hope of some explanation, but Jacob had gone. "I told you the truth yesterday. I have nothing left to give Rukenau, and I will not be seduced with the tales of the Domus Mundi." Stepping away from the tree, the man walked toward Will, and to add to the sum of the mysteries here, Will realized that, though the stranger was several years his senior and lankily tall, they were looking at one another eye to eye, which meant that he had somehow sprung up a foot and a half in height. "I don't want to know the world that way, Jacob," the man was saying. "I want to see it through my own eyes." "Jacob," Will thought, "he's looking straight at me, and he's calling me Jacob. That means I'm in Steep's body. I'm looking out through his eyes." The idea didn't frighten him. Quite the reverse. He stretched a little, and it seemed to him he could feel the muscle of the man enveloping him, heavy and strong. He inhaled and smelled his own sweat. He raised his hand and fingered the silken curls of his beard. It was the most extraordinary feeling. Though he was the possessor here, he felt possessed, as though being in Steep had put Steep in his being. There were appetites in his hips and head he'd never felt before. He wanted to be off, away from this melancholic youth, out under the sky testing this borrowed flesh, running until his lungs were furnaces, stretching until his joints cracked. To go naked in this glorious anatomy, yes, wouldn't that be fine? To eat in it, piss from it, stroke its long limbs. But he wasn't the master here. Memory was. He had sufficient freedom to scratch his beard or his groin, but he couldn't leave the business that had brought Steep back to this place. All he could do was sit behind Jacob's gilded eyes and listen to what had been said this sunlit day. He had conjured this encounter against Steep's will, it had seemed. "I don't want this," Jacob had said over and over. Yet now that it was here, it had a momentum all of its own, and he wasn't about to contest its authority for fear he lose the simple joy of standing in the man, flesh in flesh. "Sometimes, Thomas," Jacob was saying, "you look at me as though I were the very devil." The other man shook his head, his greasy hair falling across his forehead. He pushed it back with a long-fingered hand, stained red and blue. "If you were the devil, you wouldn't be Rukenau's creature now, would you?" he said. "You wouldn't let him dispatch you off to bring home runaway painters. And if you came for me, I wouldn't be able to resist you. And I can, Jacob. It's hard, but I can." He lifted his hand up above his head and drew down a blossom-laden branch to sniff. "I had a dream last night, after you'd gone. I dreamed I was up in the heavens, higher than the highest cloud, looking down at the earth, and there was somebody close to me, whispering in my ear, a soft voice, neither a woman nor a man.
Saying what?
That in all the universe there was only one planet so perfect, one so blue and bright as this, one so prodigious in its creations, and that this glory was God's very being.
God's delusion, Tom, that's what it is.
No, listen to me. You've spent too much time with Ruckenau. All this around us now isn't some trick God's playing on us. He let the branch he'd been holding go, and it sprang back into place, dropping petals down on Thomas's head and shoulders. He didn't notice. He was too inflamed by his dream and the telling of it. God knows the world through us, Jacob. He adores it with our voices. He makes our hands do its service. And at night, he looks out through our eyes, out into the immensity, and names the stars so that in time we'll sail to them. He dropped his head. That's what I dreamed.
You should tell it to Ruckenau. He loves to read the meaning in dreams.
But there's nothing to decipher, Thomas replied, grinning at the ground. That's the genius of it, don't you see?
He looked up at Will again, the sky in his head pristine.
Poor Ruckenau. He's been reciting his liturgies for so long, he's more in love with them than with the true sacrament.
And what's that, pray tell?
This,
Thomas said, plucking one of the petals off his shoulder.
I have the Holy of Holies here, the Ark of the Covenant, the Sangreal, the great mystery itself, right here on the tip of my little finger. Look.
He proffered the petal balanced on his digit.
If I could paint this perfection.
He stared at the petal as he spoke, as though mesmerized by the sight.
Put it on a sheet of paper so that it showed its true glory. Every painting in every chapel in Rome, every illumination of every book of hours, every picture I ever made for every one of Ruckenau's damned invocations would be,
he paused for the word,
superfluous.
He blew the petal from his finger, and it rose up a little way before starting its descent.
But I cannot make such a painting. I labour and I labour, and I make only failures. Jesus, sometimes, Jacob, I wish I'd been born without fingers.
Well, if you have so little use for their skill, then lend your fingers to me, Jacob said. Let me use them to make pictures half as fine as yours, and I will be the happiest man in creation.
Thomas grinned, regarding Jacob quizzically.
You say the strangest things.
I say strange things, Jacob replied. You should hear yourself, today or any day.
He laughed, and Thomas laughed along with him, his defeat momentarily forgotten.
Come back to the island with me, Jacob said, approaching Thomas cautiously, as though afraid of startling him. I'll make sure Ruckenau doesn't make a workhorse out of you.
That's not the point.
I know how he always wants things his way, how he badgers you. I won't let it happen, Tom, I swear.
Since when did you have that much authority?
Since I told him Rosa and I'd go off and leave him if he didn't let us play a little.
You wouldn't dare leave me, he said. I know your nature, and you don't.
If you desert me, you'll never know what you are or how you came to be.
And what did you say to that?
Oh, you'll be proud of me. I said, it's true. I don't know what made me. Yet was I made and made with love, and that may be knowledge enough to live in bliss.
Oh, Lord, I wish I'd been there to see his face.
He wasn't happy, Jacob chuckled. But what could he say? It was the truth.
So prettily put, too. You should be a poet.
No, I want to paint like you.
I want us to work side by side, and you teach me how to see the flow in things, the way you do. The island's so beautiful, and there's just a few fishermen who live there, too cowed to say boo to the likes of us. We can live as though we were in Eden, you, me, and Rosa.
Let me think about it, Thomas said.
One more persuasion.
Leave it alone now?
No, hear me out. I know you don't trust Rukenau's Gnostics, and a lot of the time, in truth, they confound me too. But the Domus Mundi isn't an illusion. It's glorious, Thomas. You'll be astonished when you move in it and feel it move in you. Rukenau says it's a vision of the world from the inside out.
And how much laudanum does he have you imbibe before you see this vision?
None, I swear. I wouldn't lie to you, Tom. If I thought this was just another delirium, I'd tell you to stay here and paint petals. But it isn't. It's something divine, something we're allowed to know if our hearts are strong enough. Lord, Tom, just imagine the petals you could paint if you studied them first in the seed, or in the shoot, or in the sap that made a bud come from a twig.
That's what the Domus Mundi shows you?
Well, to be honest, I haven't dared go very far inside, but yes, that's what Rukenau says. And if we were together, we could go deep, deep inside. We could see the seed of the seed, I swear.
Thomas shook his head. I don't know whether to be excited or afraid, he said.
If what you're telling me is true, then Rukenau has a way to God. I think he has, Jacob said softly. He studied Thomas, who could no longer look at him. I won't press you for an answer now, he said, but I have to know yea or nay by noon tomorrow. I've already lingered here longer than I intended.
I'll have made up my mind by tomorrow.
Don't look so melancholy, Tom, Jacob said. I meant to inspire you.
Maybe I'm not ready for the revelation.
You're ready, Jacob said. More than me, certainly. More than Rukenau, probably. He's brought into being something he doesn't understand, Tom. You could help him, I dare say. Well, we'll say no more about it today. Just promise me you won't get drunk and maudlin thinking about all of this. I fear for you when you get into those villainous moods of yours.
I won't, Thomas replied. I'll be merry thinking of you and me and Rosa going naked all day.
Good, said Jacob, leaning over to touch Thomas's unshaven cheek. Tomorrow you'll wake up and wonder why you waited so long.
With that, he turned his back on Thomas and started to stride away. If this was the end of the memory, Will thought, it was hard to see why Jacob had been so troubled at the prospect of reliving it. But the past was not done with its unravelling yet. On the third stride, Will felt the world inhale again, and the sunlight suddenly dimmed. He looked up through the blossomed branches. In an instant, the perfect sky had been blinded by clouds, and the wind brought rain against his face.
Thomas, he said,
and turning on his heel, looked back toward the place where the painter had been standing. He was nowhere to be seen. This is tomorrow, Will thought. He's come for his answer.
Thomas, Jacob called again. Where are you?
There was dry dread in his voice and a churning in his bowels as though he already knew something was amiss. The thicket ahead of him shook, and the red fox walked into view, redder today than he'd been the day before. He licked his chops as he went, his long grey tongue curling up around his snout. Then he slunk away. Jacob's gaze didn't follow him, but went instead to the clump of wild rose and hazel from which the animal had emerged.
Oh, Jesus, a voice murmured. Look away. You hear me?
Will heard, but his eyes continued to scrutinize the thicket. There was something on the ground beyond the tangle. He couldn't yet see what.
Look away, damn you,
Steep raged. "Are you listening to me, boy?"
"He means me," Will thought. "The boy he's talking to is me."
"Quickly," Steep said. "There's still time."
His rage mellowed into a plea.
"There's no need for us to see this," he said. "Just let it go, boy, let it go!"
Perhaps the pleading was a distraction intended to conceal an attempt to take control, because the next moment Will's head was filled with a rushing sound, and the scene in front of him gasped, then flickered out. The next instant he was back in the winter wood, his teeth chattering, the taste of salt blood in his mouth from a bitten lip. Jacob was still in front of him, his eyes streaming with tears.
"Enough," he said.
But the distraction, whether intentional or no, only kept the memory at bay a moment. Then the world shook again, and Will was back in Jacob's trembling body, standing in the rain. The last of Jacob's resistance seemed to have melted away. Though the man's gaze had flitted from the blossom during their brief departure, all Will had to do was call it back to the rose thicket, and it dutifully went. There was one last exhausted sound from the man that might have been a word of protest. If it was, Will failed to catch it, and would not have acted upon the objection anyway. He was the master of this anatomy now, eyes, feet, and all that lay between. He could do what he wished with it, and right now he didn't want to run or eat or piss. He wanted to see. He commanded Steep's feet to move, and they carried him forward until he had sight of what the thicket had concealed. It was Thomas the painter, of course. Who else? He was lying face up on the wet grass, his sandals and his pants and his stained shirt strewn about him, his corpse become a palette arrayed with colours of its own. Where the painter had exposed his skin to the sun over the years, his face and neck, his arms and feet, he was tanned a ruddy sienna. Where he'd been covered, which was to say every other place, he was a sickly white. Here and there, in the bony clefts of his chest and the groove of his abdomen, and at his armpits, he had gingery hair. But there were upon him colours far more shocking than these. A patch of vivid scarlet on his groin, where the fox had dined on his penis and testicles. And pooling in the paint pots of his eyes, the same bright hue, where birds had taken his tender sight. And along the flank of his body, a flap of livid fat exposed by the teeth or beak of a creature wanting to partake of his liver. It was a more radiant yellow than a buttercup.
"Happy now?" Jacob murmured.
Whether this question was meant for his occupant or the corpse before them, Will didn't dare inquire. He dragged Jacob to revisit this appalling vision against the man's wishes, and now he felt shame at what he'd done. Sickened, too. Not at the sight of the body. That didn't bother him particularly. It was no more horrible than the meat hanging up in a butcher's window. What made him want to look away was the thought that this thing before him was probably the way Nathaniel had looked, give or take a wound. Will had always imagined Nathaniel somehow perfected in death, his injuries erased by kindly hands, so that his mother could remember him immaculate. Now he knew differently. Nathaniel had been thrown through a shoe store window. There was no concealing wounds so deep. No wonder Eleanor had wept for months and locked herself away. No wonder she'd taken to eating pills instead of bread and eggs. He hadn't understood how terrible it must have been for her, sitting beside Nathaniel's bed while he slipped away. But he understood now, and understanding, he blushed with shame at his cruelty. He'd had enough. It was time to do as Steep had wanted all along and look away. But now the shoe was on the other foot, and Steep knew it.
"Do you want to take a closer look?"
Will heard him say, and the next moment Steep was going down on his haunches beside Thomas's corpse, scrutinising it wound by wound. It was Will who flinched now,
his curiosity more than sated. But Jacob wouldn't give him release. "Look at him!" Steep murmured, his gaze going to Thomas's mutilated groin. "That fox made a meal of him, eh?" There was a phony jocularity in Steep's tone. He felt this as deeply as Will, perhaps more so. "Serves him right. He should have got some pleasure from his prick while he still had it to wave around. Poor pathetic Thomas. Rosa tried to seduce him more than once, but he could never get it up. I told him, if you don't want Rosa, who has everything a man could want in a woman, then you can't want a woman at all. You're a sodomite, Tom. He said I was too simple." Steep leaned over and peered more closely at the wound. The fox's needle teeth had done a neat job. If not for the blood and a few remnants of tissue, the man could have been born unsexed.
"Well, you look like the simple one now, Thomas," Steep said, taking his gaze from gelded groin to blinded head.
There was another colour here, which Will hadn't noticed until now. On the inner surfaces of the painter's lips, and on his teeth and tongue, a bluish tinge.
"You poisoned yourself, didn't you?" Steep said.
He leaned closer to Thomas's face.
"Why did you do a damn fool thing like that? Not because of Rooker now, surely. I would have protected you from him, didn't I promise?"
He reached out and brushed the back of his fingers across the man's cheek, the way he had as they parted the day before.
"Didn't I tell you you'd be safe with Rosa and me? Oh, Lord, Tom, I would not have seen you suffer."
He leaned back from the body and, in a louder voice than he'd used hitherto, as though making a formal declaration, said,
"Rookernow's to blame. You gave him your genius. He paid you in lunacy. That makes him a thief, at very least. I won't serve him after this, and I will never forgive him. He can stay in his wretched house forever, but he won't have me for company, nor Rosa neither."
He got to his feet.
"Goodbye, Tom," he said more softly. "You would have liked the island."
Then he turned his back on the body, the way he'd turned his back on the living man the day before, and strode away. As he did so, the scene began to flicker out, the pattering rain, the roses and the body that lay under both, dimming in a heartbeat. But as they went, Will caught a glimpse of the fox, standing at the limit of the trees, gazing back at him. A shaft of sun had pierced the rain clouds and found the animal, stretching its lean flanks and keen head and flickering brush in gold. In the instant before the vision fled, Will met the beast's unblinking stare. There was nothing contrite in its look. No shame that it had fed on Pudenda today. "I'm a beast," its stare seemed to say. "Don't you dare judge me." Then they were both gone, the fox and the sun that blessed it, and Will was back in the dark copse above Burnt Yarley. In front of him stood Jacob, his hand still caught in Will's grip.
"Had enough," Steep said.
By way of reply, Will simply let go of the man's hand. Yes, it was enough. More than enough. He looked all around him to be certain nothing of what he'd witnessed had lingered, reassured by what he saw. The trees were once again leafless, the ground frosted, and the only corpses upon it, two birds. One broken, one stabbed. In fact, he was by no means certain that this was even the same wood.
"Did it happen here?"
he asked, looking back at Jacob. The man's tear-stained face was slack, his eyes glazed. It took a few moments for him to focus his attention upon the question.
"No," he said finally. "Simeon lived in Oxfordshire that year."
"Who, Simeon?"
"Thomas Simeon, the man you just met."
Will tried the name for himself.
"Thomas Simeon?"
"It was the May of 1730. He was 23 years old.
He poisoned himself with his pigments, which he mixed himself, arsenic and sky blue.
If it happened in some other place, Will said, why did you remember it?
Because of you, Jacob replied softly. You brought him to mind in more ways than one.
He looked away from Will, out through the trees, toward the valley.
I'd known him since he was about your age. He was like my own to me, too gentle for this world of illusions. It made him mad trying to find his way through this profligate creation.
He glanced back at Will, his eyes as sharp as his blade.
God's a coward and show-off, Will. You will come to understand this as the years go by.
He hides behind a gaudy show of forms, boasting how fine his workings are.
But Thomas had it right. Even in his wretched state, he was wiser than God.
Jacob raised his hand, palm up in front of his face, his little finger extended. The significance of the gesture was perfectly clear. All that was missing was the petal.
If the world were a simpler place, we would not be lost in it, he said. We wouldn't be greedy for novelty. We wouldn't always want something new, always something new. We'd live the way Thomas wanted to live, in awe of the mysteries of a petal.
Even as he spoke, Steep seemed to hear the yearning in his own voice and turned it to ice.
You made a mistake, boy, he said, his hand closing into a fist. You drank where it wasn't wise to drink. My memories are in your head now. So's Thomas, and the fox, and the madness.
Will didn't like the sound of this at all.
What madness? He said. You can't see all that you've seen. You can't know what we now both know without something souring.
He put his thumb to the middle of his skull.
You've supped from here, Wunderkind, and neither of us can ever be the same. Don't look so frightened. You were brave enough to come with me this far.
But only because you were with me.
What makes you think we can ever be apart after this?
You mean we can still go away together?
No, that won't be possible. I'll have to keep you at a distance. A great distance, for both our sakes.
But you just said...
That we'd never be apart, nor will we. But that doesn't mean you'll be at my side. There would be too much pain for both of us, and I don't wish that for you any more than you wish it for me.
He was talking the way he would to an adult, Will knew, and it soothed a little of the disappointment. This talk of pain between them, of places where Jacob didn't want to look. This was the vocabulary one man would use talking to another. He would diminish himself in Jacob's eyes if he answered like a petulant child. And what was the use? Plainly, Jacob wasn't going to change his mind.
So, where will you go now? Will said, attempting to be casual. I'll go about my work.
And what's that? Will said. Jacob had spoken of his work several times, but he'd never been specific about it.
You already know more than's best for either of us, Jacob replied.
I can keep a secret.
Then keep what you know, Jacob said. There,
he put his fist to his chest, where only you can touch it. Will made a fist of his numb fingers and echoed Jacob's gesture. It earned him a wan smile.
Good, he said. Good. Now, go home.
Those were the words Will had hoped so hard not to hear. Hearing them now, he felt tears pricking his eyes. But he told himself he wasn't to cry. Not here, not now. And they receded. Perhaps Jacob saw the effort he'd made, because his face, which had been stern, softened.
Maybe we'll find each other again somewhere down the road.
You think so?
It's possible, he said. Now go off home. Leave me to meditate on what I've lost.
He sighed.
First the book, then Rosa, now you.
He raised his voice a little.
I said, go.
You lost a book, Will said. Sherwood's got it." Will waited, daring to hope the information might give him a reprieve. Another hour in Jacob's company, at least.
"Are you sure?"
"I'm sure," Will said. "Don't worry, I'll go get it from him. I know where he lives. It'll be easy."
"Now don't be lying to me," Jacob warned.
"I wouldn't do that," Will said, offended at the accusation. "I swear."
Jacob nodded.
"I believe you," he said. "You would be of great service to me if you put the book back in my hand."
Will grinned.
"That's all I want to do. I want to be of service."
Chapter 12. There was no magic in the descent, no sense of anticipation, no strengthening hand laid on Will's nape to help him negotiate the snow-slickened rocks. Jacob had done all the touching he intended to do. Will was left to fend for himself, which meant that he fell repeatedly. Twice he slithered several yards on his rump, bruising and scraping himself on buried boulders as he tried to bring his careening to a halt. It was a cold, painful, and humiliating journey. He longed for it to be over quickly. Halfway down the hill, however, his misery was made complete by the reappearance of Rosa McGee. She appeared out of the murk, calling for Jacob, with sufficient alarm in her voice that Jacob told Will to wait while he spoke to her. Rosa was plainly agitated. Though Will could hear nothing of the exchange, he saw Jacob lay a reassuring hand on her, nodding and listening, then replying with his head close to hers. After perhaps a minute, he returned to Will and told him,
"Rosa's had a little trouble. We're going to have to be careful."
"Why?"
"Don't ask questions," Jacob replied. "Just take my word for it. Now," he pointed down the hill, "we have to hurry."
Will did as he was told and headed on down the slope. He cast one backward glance at Rosa and saw that she'd squatted down on a flat-topped rock, from which she seemed to be staring back toward the courthouse. Had she been ousted, he wondered? Was that what all her distress was about? He would probably never know. More weary and dispirited by the stride, he continued his descent. There was, he saw, a good deal of activity in the streets of the village, several cars with their headlights blazing, people gathered in groups here and there. The doors of many of the houses stood open, and people were standing on the steps in their nightclothes, watching events.
"What's going on?" Will wondered aloud.
"Nothing we need concern ourselves with," Jacob replied.
"They're not looking for me, are they?"
"No, they're not," Jacob said.
"It's her, isn't it?" Will said, the mystery of Rosa's distress suddenly solved. "They're after Rosa."
"Yes, I'm afraid they are," Jacob replied. "She's got herself in some trouble, but she's perfectly capable of looking after herself. Why don't we just stop for a moment and examine our options?"
Will duly stopped, and Jacob descended the slope a stride or two until they stood just a couple of yards apart. It was the closest he'd been to Will since the wood.
"Can you see where your friends live from here?"
"Yes."
"Point it out to me, will you?"
"You see past where the police car's parked? There's a bend in the road."
"I see."
"There's a street just around the bend, going left."
"I see that too."
"That's Sampson Road," Will said. "They live in the house with the junkyard beside it."
Jacob was silent for a few seconds while he studied the lay of the land.
"I can get the book for you,"
Will reminded him, just in case he was thinking of going on alone.
"I know," Jacob said. "I'm relying on you, but I don't think it'd be very wise for us to just walk through the middle of the village right now."
"We can go around the back," Will said. He pointed out a route that would take them another half hour to complete, but would keep them out of the way of witnesses.
"It seems the wisest option," Jacob said.
He teased off his right-hand glove and reached into his coat to take out his knife.
"Don't worry," he said, catching Will's anxious glance. "I won't taint it with human blood unless it's strictly necessary."
Will shuddered. An hour ago, climbing the hill with Jacob, he'd felt happier than he'd felt in his life before. The feel of that blade had made his palm tremble with pleasure, and the little deaths he'd caused filled him with pride. Now all that seemed like another world, another Will. He looked down at his hands. He'd never finished scrubbing them clean, and even in the murk he could see that they were still stained with the bird's blood. He felt a spasm of self-disgust. If he could have fled then and there, he might well have done so, but that would have left Jacob searching for the book on his own, and Will didn't dare risk that, not while he was carrying that knife of his. Will knew from experience how self-possessed it could be, how eager to do harm. Turning his back on man and knife, he resumed his descent, no longer heading directly into the village, but around it, so as to bring them undiscovered to the Cunninghams' doorstep. When Franny woke, the clock beside the bed said 5:25. She got up anyway, knowing that her father, who had always been an early riser, would also be up in the next 15 minutes. In fact, she found him in the kitchen, already fully dressed, pouring himself a cup of tea and smoking a cigarette. He gave her a grim little smile of welcome. "Something's going on out there," he said, spooning sugar into his tea. "I'm going out to see what's happening." "Have some toast first," she said. She didn't wait for a reply. She took a loaf out of the bread bin, then went to the drawer for the bread knife, then to the cooker to turn on the grill, and back to slice the bread. And all the time, to-ing and fro-ing, she was thinking how strange it was to be pretending that there was nothing really different about the world this morning, when she knew in her heart that this wasn't so. It was her father who finally spoke, his back to her as he gazed out of the kitchen window. "I don't know," he said. "Things going on these days." He shook his head. "Used to be safe for folks." Franny had slid two slices of the thickly cut bread beneath the grill, and, fetching her favourite mug out of the cupboard, poured herself some tea. Like her dad, she sugared it heavily. They were the two sweet tooths in the family. "It makes me scared for you sometimes," her father said, turning back to look at Franny. "The way the world's going." "I'll be all right, Dad," she said. "I know you will," he said, though his expression belied his words. "We'll all be fine." He opened his arms to her, and she went to him, hugging him hard. "Only you'll see as you get older," he said. "There's more bad out there than good. That's why you work hard to make a safe place for the people you love. Somewhere you can lock the door." He rocked her in his embrace. "You're my princess, you know that." "I know," she said, smiling up at him. A police car roared past, siren blaring. The happiness faded from George Cunningham's face. "I'll butter us some toast," Franny said, patting his chest. "That'll make us feel better." She pulled the slices out from under the grill and flipped them over. "You want some marmalade?"
"No, thanks," he said, watching her as she fussed around. To the fridge for some butter, then back to the cooker where she picked up the hot toast and put it on a plate. Then she slathered on the butter, the way she knew he liked it.
"There,"
she said, presenting him with the toast. He wolfed it down, murmuring his approval. All she needed now was milk for her tea. The carton was empty, but the milkman might have arrived by now, so she padded through to the front door to fetch the delivery. The front door had been bolted top and bottom, which was unusual. Plainly her parents had gone to bed nervous. Franny reached up and unbolted the top, then, stooping to unbolt the bottom, opened the door. There was still no sign of the day. Not a glimmer. It was going to be one of those winter days when light barely seemed to touch the world before it was gone again. The snow had stopped falling, however, and the street looked like a well-made bed in the lamplight. Plump white pillows piled against walls, and quilts laid on roofs and pavements. She found the sight comforting in its prettiness. It reminded her that Christmas would soon be here, and there'd be reasons for songs and laughter. The step was empty. The milk was late being delivered today. Oh, well, she thought, I'll have to do without. And then the sound of feet crunching on snow. She looked up and saw somebody had appeared at the opposite side of the street. Whoever it was stood beyond the lamplight, but only for a few moments. Realizing he'd been seen, he stepped out of the grey gloom and into view. It was Will. Chapter 13. Rosa waited on the rock, listening. They would be upon her soon, her pursuers. She could hear every creak of their snow-caked boots as they followed her trail up the hillside to where she sat. One of them, there were four, was smoking as he climbed. She could see the pinprick of his cigarette brightening whenever he drew on it. One of them was young, his breathing easier than that of his companions. One took out a flask of brandy every now and then, and, when he offered it around, had a distinct slur in his voice. The fourth was quieter than the others, but sometimes, if she listened very carefully, she thought she heard him murmuring something to himself. It was too indistinct for her to understand, but she suspected it was a prayer. Her exchanges with Jacob had been quite straightforward. She'd freely admitted to what she'd done in the courthouse, and told him he'd better get out of harm's way before the mob was upon them. He told her he would not be leaving the vicinity just yet. He had work to do in the village. When she asked him what manner of work, he told her he wasn't about to share secrets with a woman who'd probably be under interrogation before dawn. "Is that a dare, Mr. Steep?" she said. "You might take it that way, I suppose," he replied. "Would you have their deaths on my conscience?" she said, to which he replied, "What conscience?" His response had amused her mightily, and for a few moments, standing there on the hillside with Jacob, it had almost seemed like old times. "Well," she said, "now you've been warned." "Is that all you're going to do?" Jacob had replied. "Warn me, then walk away." "What else do you suggest?" she said with a little smile. "I want you to make sure they don't come after me." "So say it," she whispered. "Say, kill them for me, Rosa." She leaned closer to him. His heartbeat had quickened. She'd heard it, loud and clear. "If you want them dead, Jacob, then all you have to do is ask." Her lips were so close to his ear, they were almost touching. "Nobody's going to know but us." He'd said nothing for a few seconds, and then, in that resigned voice of his, he'd murmured the words she'd wanted to hear. "Kill them for me." Then he'd gone on his way with the boy. Now she